This is work in progress. Actually, completed work with Nikita Sapenko. I'm gonna post it sometime this week. He's now my former graduate student, now at Institute for Advanced Study. So, first of all, if you just want to hear the executive summary, you can leave like after you hear this, if you like have things to do. So here it is. First of all, at hoped anomalies on the lattice are not the same as anomalies in quantum field theory, but nevertheless, one can the dynamical consequences are very similar. And that's one of the main results of our work. Also, somewhat unrelated, well, we focus on one-dimensional case, but it's probably true in higher dimensions too. Also, another thing we want to clarify in this work is sort of how to think about group cohomology for Lie groups. If you kept track of some developments in condensed matter physics, you know that group cohomology was used to classify, say, symmetry particular topological phases, SPT phases, in various dimensions, but most of the work assumes that the group is finite because it's kind of difficult. Well, what to do when the group is Lie group, we'll see why it's horrible. So we have a way around this. Well, I think we found the sort of the right way to think about continuous Lie groups. And finally, if you're like mathematically minded, actually it's simplicial sets and module on simplicial objects and categories kind of useful sometimes. Otherwise, you'll see one slide where I try to, it's not going to appear in the actual talk. There's one slide when I try to write formulas down without using this technology, and it's horrible. So sometimes useful. Okay, so here's the actual outline. I'll first remind you what at Hooft anomalies are in quantum field theory. And then I'll discuss something rather different, but actually which looks has similar flavor, namely Lipschultz-Matis theorem. And then I will also review anomalies of on a lattice following the work of Nayaka and Dominic here. And then I'll just explain new results in an informal way because, you know, to state them properly will take some time and maybe end up with some more rigorous definitions. Just understand better what we actually proved. There'll be no actual proofs. You know, there's no time to prove anything in this talk. Now, so what is a Hooft anomaly? Suppose you have some global symmetry G, and you try to gauge G. I'm explaining how physicists usually explain it. You try to gauge G, and sometimes you fail. And the abstraction to gauging is called the Hooft anomaly. And that Hooft didn't invent them. But he was the first to realize that such abstractions are important because they provide constraints on the normalization group flow. And these constraints come from a Hooft anomaly matching. So Hooft argued that if you look at the UV theory and the IR theory, the Hooft anomaly must be the same. So in particular, as a consequence of this Hooft anomaly matching, if you have non-trivial Hooft anomaly, then you cannot have a trivially gapped symmetric vacuum because the corresponding effective field theory would have would be g-invariant and completely trivial, so it has trivial Hooft anomalies. So anomaly matching, this cannot happen. By the way, funny fact, so Nadia Seiberg gave me a lot of grief when I called this a Hooft anomalies at first. So it's a Hooft anomaly matching, not a Hooft anomaly. Not a Hooft anomaly matching. But then eventually he came around. Now I'd like to also discuss where it's not only some abstraction, but what does it mean? We would like some well-defined place where these abstractions take values. Now the answer, well, let me summarize what people say usually in this case. We talk about only internal symmetry here, so no space-time symmetries for now, at least. That kind of different answers people give, which is already a bit unsatisfactory. First of all, suppose you have a compact connected Lie group. Like a U1 or a U2, then that's the original context in which anomalies have been discovered by Adler and Bell and Jakiewicz in the 1960s. So in that case, after some work, it was agreed upon that these anomalies are classified by Chern-Simons terms in one dimension higher. Chern-Simons terms for the G gauge field. So in particular, with this definition, of course, anomalies exist only in even spatial. Sorry, in odd spatial dimension space-time dimension. Because Chern-Simons terms only exist in odd space-time dimension. Now, for finite groups, well, finite groups also appear in QFT context, for example, in the context of orbifolding. I think in the maybe in the work of, say, Vatha on asymmetric orbifolds in the context of 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory. And their conclusion was that anomalies take values in cohomology, in the group cohomology of the group. I'll remind you what it is a bit later, of degree d plus 2, when d is a spatial dimension. All this talk, d is going to be spatial dimension. But not for long, because soon d is going to be 1. I'm going to simplify life by setting d equals 1. But for now, it's general. Now, so this is, again, this has been around for a while. But for finite g, actually, there's a better answer, which takes into account gravitational anomalies, mixed anomalies, between internal symmetry and gravitation and gravity and diffeomorphisms. And people now say, well, you need to look at oriented Bordism group of degree d plus 2 of the classifying space of the group. And well, precisely, you need to look at the characters, a one-dimensional representation of this abelian group, or Pontryagin dual of that group. So what is BG? Well, it's classifying space of G bundles, but it's not really a space. It's more it's a space defined up to homotopy. So it's a homotopy type. And what is it? Oops. See what's going on? Okay. So what's BG? Well, this BG is any space which has this property that it's pi 1 is G, and other than that, it's trivial. All other homotopy groups are trivial. And it turns out that it uniquely defines a homotopy type. So for example, if say, well, simplest example, G, well, it's not really finite, but G is, say, a group of integers under addition. Well, in that case, you can just take BG to be S1. That clearly has the right properties. So in other cases, of course, even for very simple G, you can get some pretty horrible, you need to look for some pretty horrible spaces. Well, you can also improve this further. You can incorporate time reversal, which is discrete space-time symmetry, by replacing oriented Bordism with unoriented Bordism. You can also incorporate fermions, because this is purely bosonic answer. I need to look at the spin board, but this talk, we're not going to worry about this. Now, okay, I already said that Bordisms are better than group cohomology because they take into account mixed anomalies, mixed between diffeomorphisms in the group and symmetric group G. But we're going to be staying in dimension 1, so it's not important. Actually, in low dimensions, it just doesn't matter because it turns out that this Bordism group, anyway, is the same as the homology group of the classifying space. And, well, I write sing means like singular homology, that is the usual topological homology of the space. And it's the dual is then, well, and then the dual of that is simply the d plus 2 degree, d plus 2 cohomology of the same space. So it just means that there's nothing, and that's actually the same as degree d plus 2 homology, the cohomology of the group itself. Now, but when I say homology of a group, I don't mean homology of this thing as a topological space. I mean as algebraic object. It's important to keep in mind because if I generalize, in this case, actually, G is finite, so it becomes nonsensical to look at topological one, it's a discrete group. But when G is Lie group, then it becomes, you need to keep track of which cohomology you're talking about. And so when I have topological cohomology, I write sing, singular homology or cohomology, standard terminology, because you define using singular simplices. Okay. Anyway, so for low dimensional G, it's all very simple. For d equals 0, for example, you get that QFT anomalies for finite g takes values, well, in this degree 2 cohomology, or if you wish, in degree 2 singular cohomology of the corresponding classifying space, it's the same thing. And in dimension 1, supposedly takes values here. That's the case of orbifolds, the one which Vafa discussed first. And there are no mixed anomalies in these low dimensions. Now, to see why this is, in what sense it's an anomaly, let's look at really toy case, namely d equals 0. What's going on?
During the bosonic systems only.
Only bosonic, yeah. So look at d equals 0, for example. Why is this an anomaly? Well, this is just a case of quantum mechanics. What is actually H2? Well, its explicit description is the Tuca cycles of G modulo Tuca boundaries. What does it mean? Well, it just means you have a cocycle is just a function of two group elements with values in U1 in this case, because it's U1 coefficients, which satisfy this condition, called cocycle condition. And coboundaries are just solutions of this form, where psi is a function of a single group element. That's what it means. So then why is it relevant? Why co-cycles modular co-bundles relevant? Well, because the same things arise when you study projective representations of G. So if you look at homomorphisms to the projective unitary group of the Hilbert space, well, you can lift this homomorphism to a map from your group to the unitary group, but at the expense of violating maybe the usual notion of homomorphism by some phase. So that phase, you can easily check, is a cocycle, is a two cocycle. So there was a twist. So a projective representation is basically like a homomorphism, but twisted by some two cocycle. And if you change the lift, changes you had by some phase, then all it does, it changes the two cocycle, but two co-boundary. So, why is it an anomaly? So why are projective representations then same as the Tufte anomalies? Well, if you try to gauge, you start with the Hilbert space and look for gene variant rays. But if the cocycle is non-trivial, there are no gene variant rays in the Hilbert space. That means you cannot gauge. In other words, if you decided to enforce the gauge invariance, you're going to find that you have the only vector is zero. The only evaluator is zero. So your Hilbert space is zero dimensional. Also, another consequence of this, not related to gauging, suppose you have a gene variant Hamiltonian and the symmetry is projective, then ground state of this Hamiltonian necessarily forms a representation of this group and therefore cannot be one dimensional. So it must be dimensional greater than one. So you cannot have a gene variant Hamiltonian, cannot have unique ground state in mechanics if you have projective symmetry, unique and gene variant. Now, I'm going to discuss 1D case in more detail, but for now, let's just recall in general, degree 3 cohomology is defined similarly. So you have some 3 cocycles, which are some functions of 3 group elements with values in U1, satisfying some condition, which now involves a bit more complicated, it's a 5 term condition. And the 3 co-boundary is a special type of 3 cocycles of this form, which depend on the arbitrary function from group to group squared to U1. So you take that group of all 3 cocycles divided by 3 co-boundaries and you get something. That's degree 3 cohomology. It's less obvious why this has to do with Tufte anomalies. Now, I want to say why Lie groups are problematic from this point of view. The problem is that they're uncountably infinite. So if you you can formally say, I can define group cohomology even for, it's a pretty algebraic definition, I can apply it to Lie group. But it's going to be insane. So, because if you look at the group of cachains, which are arbitrary functions, not constrained yet, right? The group of cachains is an arbitrary function from the several copies of the group to U1. That's a map from uncountably infinite thing to anything, pretty much, has cardinality which is strictly larger than the cardinality of the continuum. That's Cantor's theorem. So these are incredibly humongous sets. So there's no way to work with them. So you get your cohomology is some humongous set factored by some other humongous set, and you have no idea what's left over when you do that. So it could be small, could be larger. It's impossible to work with this. If you ask take a group like SU2, what's its degree 3 cohomology in the algebraic sense? Nobody knows. It's impossible to compute. Now there's some proposal in the physics literature to use measurable cocycles instead. Well, you have a group, so it's a topological group. So there's a natural measure in it called notion of a measurable set called Borel set, and then you can restrict your cocycles by asking them to be measurable. Well, why not continuous ones? Well, because if we're continuous, that somehow gives wrong results. Let's try measurable then. There's no real justification for that, by the way.
For example, if you classify projective representation that is classified by the measurable in that sense, it seems.
No, it's coincidence, I think, in some sense. So it's not natural. I mean, you can ask why it should be measurable. Why should measurable cocycle appear? Measurable cocycles appear if your matrix element of representation are measurable functions. Nobody ever imposes this condition. Like maybe natural for some mathematician, but physics is just weird. When dealing with the Lie group, you usually talk about smooth things. So I'll get back to it later. So, but
you can always find the gauge.
Okay.
You probably always find the gauge that's local.
Well, I'll discuss it later. But somehow measurable, just not natural. And and plus, you know, okay. So if a group is connected, of course, you can use Chern-Simons prescription. But it, first of all, it's unsatisfactory to have different prescriptions for different types of groups. And second, what do you do with groups which are neither finite nor connected, like, say, O2? Okay, so second, let's discuss Lipschultz-Mattis theorem. So what is this thing? So it's a really old result. Well, it says that in some cases, if you have symmetries, then any Hamiltonian with a symmetry cannot have a unique gap ground state and thermodynamic limit. So originally this was formulated for some concrete examples of Hamiltonians with some concrete symmetries, but later it was realized, first of all, Hamiltonian is not important. The important thing is how the symmetry is realized. And for example, in the original paper, you had a projective representation of the symmetry group was SO3 times translations. So SO3 acted on site, on each side of the lattice separately. And but the, in each site you had a projective representation SO3 like spin a half, for example, and that led to some weirdness, which led to the statement that no Hamiltonian with this symmetry can have a translation invariant and SO3 symmetric unique ground state and thermodynamic limit. Now there's a version of this which was proved quite recently, where you replace SO3 with an arbitrary finite symmetry group. That's work of Ogata, Tachikawa, and Tasaki. It's a non-trivial generalization because the arguments that Lipschultz and Mattis used don't apply to finite groups, but there's an alternative reasoning which gives you the same result for finite groups. Now, this looks very much like a Tuft anomaly matching because dynamical consequence is the same. You cannot have a unique gap ground state. But what sort of symmetry are we talking about? Can one interpret both LSM theorem and related LSM type results as consequence of some anomaly. Okay. Now, it's not as easy as it might seem, because first of all, in the case of LSM, clearly you need to use both translations and this on-site internal SO3 symmetry. You know, there's no result if you drop either of them. So it's sort of mixed anomaly, if you wish. But if you, in QFT, of course, there are no mixed anomalies between translations and some internal symmetry. Now, in physics papers, people looked at this question, and if you have a quantum field theory description of Lorentz effective field theory, typically what happens in this example is that your Lorentz effective field theory has some extra, say Chang and Saber called it eminent Z2, which somehow emerges from the translations in translational symmetry. And the anomaly that is then mixed between SO3 and this emerging or eminent Z2. That's kind of, it's not obvious why this should happen. So first of all, why should quantum field theory, first of all, why should there be quantum field theory in the infrared? That's not obvious at all. And second, why should it have some sort of additional symmetry which the theory on the lattice has, that doesn't have. So it would be more satisfactory to have some purely lattice definition of anomaly, which would lead to, among other things, to Lipschultz-Mattis theory. And that should involve translations as well as internal symmetry. So somehow, if that succeeds, then we'll see that actually the Tuft anomalies on lattice are just different from the Tuft anomalies on the QFT, because again, there's no translation, mixed translation, or whatever, internal symmetry in quantum field theory. So recently there was a paper by Saif Nashri, which also addresses the same question, but our approach is different. Yes. So now we are inspired by this work of fairly old now by Nayak and Dominic, which explained actually how to define anomaly for action or particular actions of symmetry on lattice systems. So the idea of that paper was that sometimes non-on-site actions of symmetries appear, and one can extract some sort of anomaly just from that action. You don't need any, so once you have that, you can just forget about the Hamiltonian, if you have it, and just extract some sort of anomaly just from the action, non-on-site action of the symmetry group on a lattice system. The context of that paper was actually SPT phases. So in particular, it was proposed that the way to explain this, it was proposed previously that SPT phases of bosonic systems in d-spatial dimensions are labeled by elements of this group cohomology. And I can also propose that whenever this happens, then on the edge, you have a QFT with a truth anomaly given by the same element. Question is, how to extract that? Well, let's assume that on the edge, you still have the symmetry. You have to, because it's a symmetric edge. And let's assume that it acts by, in some non-on-site way. So that's a bit of a leap, because typically the edge is not described by a lattice system. The edge is described by quantum field theory. But let's forget about that. Let's assume that we're dealing with the lattice system in the one dimension lower, and ask what possible non-on-site actions of the symmetry group are. And let's try to assign some element of this guy to such non-on-site actions. So I already said all this. Now, so two assumptions are, well, I'm going to keep this one. Another assumption, the second one, is that you act by unitary circuits. So I'll remind you what it is. In particular, in one dimension, the definition you get in this way is completely rigorous. And the great thing, it's purely kinematic. So, and you don't need Hamiltonian. That, by the way, it would be nice to have something like this in quantum field theory too, because people say that anomaly is robust, meaning it can do very violent things to your theory and it doesn't change. That's such, ideally, you would say, well, that means that you can just define anomaly without even knowing what the Lagrangian is, just from symmetries. But that's not actually how it works. There's no way to do it in quantum field theory. But in the lattice, you can. So, and another advantage is that actually, it's very clear what anomaly measures, what exactly is anomalous about some particular non-on-set action. So the further thing is in the paper is that when I have non-zero anomaly, then you cannot have a symmetric short-range entangled state. What does it mean? Well, there are different notions of short-range entanglement, but let me say the one which is relevant here. You start with an unentangled state and act on it with a circuit. Apply some unitary circuit, find a depth, and you get something else, anything you get in this way called a short range entangled. So now I can also argue that you can never, if you have this symmetry with an anomaly, then there are no states, there are no short range entangled states which are also G invariant. That is very, very similar to LSM, but not quite the same. Because first of all, it puts constraint on this short-range entangled state, but not on gap state. Now, it's believed that in one dimension, the two notions are pretty close, and then somehow you can deform any gap ground state to a short-range entangled state in this sense, but it's not a theorem. Also, another thing we'd like to fix is that, well, circuits is a bit constraining. The more general. In particular, it doesn't allow translations. A translation is not a circuit. So, and also, we have the usual problem, what we do with this anomaly. You can formally define it. The definition makes perfect sense, but it's not clear how to use it, because it's an unmanageable group. OK, so let me now discuss how we approach this. So we basically generalize Nayak-Ant-Ells result in various dimensions, various directions. By having, first of all, allowing for not strictly, not just circuits, but more general automorphisms of the algebra observables as your symmetry actions, and also allowing translations. So, the basic object is always the algebra local observables, which just, you know, in our setup, are just standard choice. You have a spin chain, so you have a matrix algebra on every side, just take product of all of matrix algebras over all sides. So I call this algebra B of V because I assume that all vector spaces on each side are the same. And B just means bounded operators. In this case, it just means matrices. And it's a norm star algebra. You complete it, you get C star algebra. It's usually called algebra of quasi-local observables, QL here. And symmetry is an automorphism of this algebra. What does it mean? Well, it's a bijective linear map from algebra to itself. Well, which algebra? Well, either this one or that one. So if you, well, depending on what you prefer. And you want to, this property called automorphism. Well, usually called commuting with star, also including part of it. So that's, now I mentioned several times, well, there are special kinds of this automorphism. I already mentioned some of them called circuits. So first of all, let's recall what a gate is. Well, a gate is automorphism of this form. It just takes some local unitary observable and conjugate everything with this local unitary observable. It's called a gate. A circuit then is just a composition of non-overlapping gates. And block partition is unitary first. It's a composition of several non-overlapping gates. And a circuit simply several layers of this block partitioned unitaries. So apply a bunch of non-overlapping gates and then repeat. The second time you apply some other non-overlapping gates and just do it a finite number of times. It's called a circuit. And an additional condition, well, typically assume that gates have a diameter not larger than something. So a circuit also has some diameter. But that diameter it maps local observable to local observable with a bigger radius. And how big? Well, it depends on the radius of your gates, which you allow, and the maximal radius, and also the number of layers. So circuits form a group, an obvious statement, and that's the group that Nayak and Els used. So let me remind you also how they actually define this index, this anomaly. So suppose you have this homomorphism from a group G to the group of circuits. First of all, for each G, you can split your automorphism into two things, two automorphisms. One acts trivially on local observable far to the left, and we call it alpha minus. Another one acts trivially on observable supported far to, the one which acts trivially on the local observables far to the left, I call alpha plus. And alpha minus is the one which acts trivially on the observable which act far to the right. What they do near zero, it doesn't matter, anything. You can choose whatever. So now when you compose these two guys, in general, they don't form representation. There's not a homomorphism in general, but they form homomorphism up to some defect. And defect is conjugation with some local observable. So the local observable is kind of like a cocycle, but it's like operator valued cocycle. And depends on a group, pair of group elements, so it's like a two, operator valued two cocycle, if you wish. Now, from this equation, you can deduce the following thing, that this combination is proportional to 1. Show that conjugation with this, as a consequence of that, doesn't do anything at all. Therefore, it must be a scalar. It must be 1 times something. Plus, everything here is unitary, so it must be not just any scalar, but a scalar with absolute value 1. So it must be an element of U1. And that turns out that this combination is a 3 cocycle. So you can satisfy this cocycle condition, which I wrote down previously. And moreover, we made a bunch of choices here. We chose this splitting. We chose this V's. But the cohomology class of this cocycle doesn't depend on all that. Well, it's kind of obvious it doesn't depend on the choice of, well, how to define V, because V anyway is defined up to a phase, but it's more non-trivial to show that the choice of this alpha plus doesn't matter. Okay, so that's how you get a cocycle. Now let's try now generalizing this a bit. So first of all, what's the problem with translation? Well, translations are not circuits. Rather it's what's called a quantum cellular automaton, QCA. So what's a quantum cellular automaton? Well, it's a kind of automorphism which maps any observable on some any local observable on some site to an observable living on a site, or not on a site, but in some region around that site of diameter R. And we assume that R is fixed. So each QCA has a particular radius. So for example, translation by one site is a QCA of radius 1 because it moves everything just to the right or to the left. QCAs form also clearly form a subgroup. Like if you have this property for two guys, the compose is still going to have property for the different radius, for the sum of two radii for the composition. Also, it's true for the inverse too. Now every circuit is a QCA, not hard to see, but not all QCAs are circuits. That's a non-trivial result due to these authors. And moreover, they actually completely classified all QCAs modulo circuits. They explain a way how to exactly figure out the obstruction to realizing particular QCA by a circuit. So what is this obstruction? Well, I call it GNVW index. This is a homomorphism from a group of QCAs to these rings. You have integer. Well, you have a. You need to first of all look at your Hilbert space on each site. Ask, okay, which look at this dimension. Ask which primes divide that dimension. For example, you have a qubit. The only prime is 2. So in that case, you just get the z here. If you have a qubit and a qudit on each side, you're going to get z plus z, one for the 2 and one for the 3. If you have two qudits and the one tridit, one qutrit, then you only get z plus z because you know two twos don't count. Okay, so that's what it means. So so this is some homomorphism like this, and its kernel is precisely the circuits. So to decide whether QCA is a circuit or not, you can just compute this index, generate double index. If it's 0, it's a circuit. If it's not, then it's not. Okay, so let me now finally state my results. First of all, there is some more bigger group, which I call group of locality preserving automorphisms. I'm going to formulate the definition later, but it's some basically you start with your definition of QCA and make it fuzzier. That is, QCA says, well, it starts with any local observable, it maps to local observable in a bigger region with some fixed radius. But here, basically, I'm saying, well, I'm allowing automorphisms which map a local observable to something which is approximately local, has some tails, but these tails decay as distance. You know, if you have something supported on site J, then applying automorphism gives you something which is supported everywhere, but it's almost supported on site J, and that's controlled by some function. Some function which is independent of where you are, which automorphism it is, or which observable it is, just some function, which tells you how big the tails are. So it's sort of fuzzy version of QCA. So here's the claim. So lots of things live in this bigger group of locality preserving automorphisms. All QCAs are there, and also evolutions with local Hamiltonians, time evolutions also there. Because every evolution has this property that it smears things out. It starts with the local thing, evolve, it already lives everywhere. So all these evolutions are also inside this big group. So suppose you have an action of a group by this locality preserving automorphisms on your lattice system, 1D lattice system. Then there is a well-defined element of here. And what's the meaning of this? Well, turns out that for this bigger group, we can also define this GNVW index. And it's easy to explain the meaning of the anomaly index, which lives here in the case when this GNVW actually vanishes. Suppose this index vanishes, the anomaly is basically the abstractions to writing your alpha of G as a product like this, where these are commuting homomorphisms, which approximately localized on the left chain and right chain. Okay. Approximately means, again, that it's acts as alpha on the right, but approaches identity on the left, and vice versa. So to make sense of this, we need to use this important work by Renard, Walter, and Witteveen to prove that this GNVW index is well-defined, actually, for this locality-preserving automorphisms. Non-trivial, rather non-trivial result. Okay, so the first result is definition of this index, anomaly index for more general automorphisms. Second one, we prove that anomaly is actually an abstraction to having gapped at symmetric ground states. So here's the theorem. Suppose you have a homomorphism like this, that is action of a symmetry group on your 1D system, and suppose there exists a Hamiltonian, finite range Hamiltonian, which is whose ground state is gene variant and gapped, then anomaly index must vanish. Contrary-wise, if you have a non-trivial anomaly index, then no Hamiltonian with its symmetry can have a unique gapped ground state. In fact, I actually maybe should mention it here. There's a version of the result which says the following. If you have a non-trivial anomaly index, no gene variant pure state can have area law. Okay. So gapped ground states are examples of states which have area law for entropy. So if you have this anomalous symmetry, then no gene variant state can have area law. And this implies LSM, Lipschultz-Mattis. That is, you just take G to be a product of the internal symmetry and the translational symmetry. And let's assume that G not acts by translations, not acts projectively on each Hilbert space, on each site. That is on-site, but projective, with some Tuca cycle. And suppose just, you know, your translations act as you would expect, just shifting everything by one. Now, this anomaly index takes value here. But since the group is a product, you can simplify it a bit. It becomes H3 of G0 plus H2 of G0. And since the action of G0 is on site, of course, the contribution here vanishes. So the only anomaly is here. And then you can go ahead and compute it for this particular case. It turns out to be precisely the cohomology class of this cocycle. So, and as a result, you get, you know, that the consequence that if you have a non-trivial projectiveness, then no gapped symmetric state, no gapped symmetric state for any Hamiltonian with this symmetry.
Didn't you say on the previous slide you want the G and beta?
Sorry?
Didn't you say on the previous slide you want the G and beta B index to vanish?
No, I'm just saying that I was explaining the meaning of this index. The index is defined for any homomorphism. But it's just easier to explain what it means, the index, what it means for this vanishing gene value. And actually, let me explain how to compute it, precisely in the case of translations. Let's do this computation, which will also illustrate how to incorporate translations. So we have this situation. We have a homomorphism from G0 to unitary group of every single-site Hilbert space. So not homomorphism, but a twisted homomorphism. So there's some cocycle there. Okay, how does it act on the whole chain? Well, just adjoint action. And the adjoint action is perfectly fine. The cocycles cancel there, so it's a genuine automorphism. For every group G, you get this on-site action. So in this case, it's a one-layer circuit, right? You just act on each site separately. Now, translations are not circuits. So how do we deal with that? Well, in this particular case, with some general procedure, in this particular case, that's how we do it. We stack with an identical system where G0 acts trivially, doesn't act at all, but translation just shifts everything in the opposite direction. So now if you look at the composite system, then this GNBW index vanishes because, you know, it cancels between the two systems because translations act oppositely. So therefore, okay, so and we define, well, so and then you can just follow Nayak and Els procedure and extract the anomaly index for this action by circuits on a composite system. And the claim is actually that the resulting anomaly index doesn't depend on the, this is the actual definition, right? And similar procedure actually works in general. When you have translate some GNBW index for your original action, you can just stack with something else and define the anomaly index to be anomaly index for this composite. So let me see how it works. So how does translations act on this composite? Say the blue one, say the original system, and the red one is whatever you added. You can present translations as a composition of two things. First, you do swap, which is clearly a circuit, and then followed by this kind of swap, which is also a circuit. It's a two-layer circuit, with my definition. So a composition can easily see its translations, which is something which translates blue sides to the right and red sides to the left. Right? So say you start the red one, just go like this, and then go like this. So that's a well-known thing. So we're going to restrict that to the half chain. It's a circuit, so you can always restrict. Now there's no unique restriction. for example, we can restrict like this, just the orange one go first, the brown one go second. So restrict like this. As for the action of the G naught, you can just say, well, just let's look at act on the right chain. It's just a side by side action, so you can just truncate in the most obvious way. And then we just, if we define things like this way, you can just see what happens. Well, now we defined your action of both translations on a half, so you truncated both sort of translations on a half chain and also your G naught. And I can follow this prescription. You want to see how much this way of defining things on a half chain failed to be a homomorphism. So on one hand, you can say, well, if I act with first with the element of the group G naught followed by translation by one site, truncated to the half chain, and then followed by element G of G naught, I get one thing. On the other hand, I can just apply simply GH and then followed by translations. How do they compare? Well, after a little computation, you find that they differ by conjugation precisely by this guy acting on the first site. More precisely, on the site of this here. On the blue system. And then, on the other hand, you get these V's, right? So, we computed a V essentially for the case when your original group elements are G and no translation, and H and translation. The similar computation for internal symmetry just gives you, of course, a trivial thing. And then you evaluate three cycles following that formula, which I wrote down before, and you can figure out, well, it's computation, but in the end, you're going to get that this cycle is what you expect. Is there a
projection. Also pick up the anomaly cycle for the on-site symmetry?
No. As far as action on observables, it's not anomalous. No. Okay, so now, that's the outline. You can also do the same similar thing for general locality preserving, action of locality preserving automorphisms on your system. Now, I want to comment now on what to do in the case when you're dealing with the Lie group. So first of all, even if you do ordinary quantum mechanics, then, you might have asked yourself, why doesn't anybody ever write a every quantum mechanics textbook says that when you look at spin representation of SO3, that's projective. Nobody ever writes down the Tuca cycle. Why don't they do that? Well, they don't do it because they can't. Well, and they can't because they don't know that, well, maybe they suspect, but they don't know they need to choose cover. You cannot, there's no smooth for, and there's no globally defined Tuca cycle for this spin representation, but you can define it in charts. But charts on what? A Tuca cycle depends on a pair of group elements. It should be charts not on the group, but on a group times itself. So it becomes pretty yucky. You need to cover a group times group, like SO3 times SO3 with charts, and then write things in every chart. So that's why people don't write it there. But anyway, so this suggests that, that's the right way to write the cycle. That suggests, and in charts, your cycles are perfectly smooth. And they're perfectly smooth because your matrix element of representation, of the spin representation, they're perfectly smooth in charts. So this suggests you actually need just work with smooth cycles, but define only locally. This is a slight technical issue. It's clear what it means for the group to act smoothly on a finite dimensional Hilbert space. Just means your matrices depend smoothly on the group element G. What about smooth homomorphism from a G into this horrible infinite dimensional group of QCAs or these locality preserving automorphisms? Well, I'm going to discuss it in detail, but there is a natural choice of a subgroup, which is kind of an infinite dimensional Lie group. So it's big enough to include arbitrary QCAs, translations, and also time evolutions with finite range Hamiltonians, and a bit more. Okay, let me just state the result for the. Okay, so there is some other group cohomology you can define for Lie groups, which is much more manageable, and it uses locally defined but smooth cocycles. It was actually introduced in some preprint by Jean-Luc Brilinski, and I call it HN differentiable group cohomology. And it's much more complicated to define, but it's much easier to compute. And it's defined for any Lie group and any abelian Lie group as a coefficient group. In our case, A is U1. And there is a definition which says that for any smooth homomorphism, in a sense defined in the paper, there's a well-defined element in this degree 3 differentiable group cohomology. And it's again an obstruction to writing things as a product. Maybe it's put the left and right half chains. And a bit more complicated argument shows that we're going to have a non-zero anomaly index in this weird group, then it does not allow gap ground states, symmetric gap ground states to exist. And that's a much more useful result in the case of Lie groups because I can actually easily compute this group and easily compute the index there. That precisely what covers, you know, that gives you the original LSM. So in that case, the group is SO3 times Z. And for any Lie group, turns out there's a similar identity as for these abstract groups, like this. So, of course, the anomaly index telling here is trivial because it's an on-site action, but you can compute the component, and this actually labels, like, what does this label, by the way? So, the usual group cohomology labels just project representation of the group. This differentiable one is a bit different. It labels, equivalence classes of smooth projective representation. That is smooth homomorphism from your group to this projective unitary group. The point is somehow that this is a manifold and this is a manifold. You can ask for smooth homomorphism, and that's what and then various equivalence classes are live here. And this group is perfectly manageable. For example, for SO3, as we expect, it's Z mod 2. So, you know, in the say for odd spins, it's non-trivial. For even spins. For half integral spins is non-trivial, for integral spins it's trivial. Everything seems very similar to QFT, but let me just emphasize this, it's not the same as QFT. So one thing I already mentioned, there are no mixed anomalies between translations and internal symmetries in QFT. Another thing is that actually this index vanishes just for internal connected Lie group symmetries. So, it's not very trivial, but it's true. Now, this is a bit seems a bit strange because in quantum field theory, we do expect anomalies for compact connected Lie groups. For example, if you look at integer quantum Hall effect, in that case, group is U1. So, we expect the edge to have anomaly for U1, and it's labeled precisely by, well, elements here. And these are simply Chern-Simons couplings for G in two dimensions, in two spatial dimensions, or two, three space-time dimensions. Certainly, there is a place for anomaly to take values. And actually, it's the same place you get for lattice models. And in case of quantum field theories, the anomaly can actually be non-zero for quantum field theory on the edge. But for lattice systems, in the sense defined above, it's actually always zero. So no spin chain can have an anomaly like quantum field theory of chiral bosons can have. No 1D lattice spin chain. It's another illustration that anomalies are different. Okay. Some more advanced things. Let's have a few minutes. So let me explain, first of all, what I mean by locality preserving automorphisms more precisely. And also how to define. Okay, let's start with differential cohomology of Lie groups. So, it looks pretty horrible unless you introduce a simplicial set technology, but let me try anyway. I'll just try to do degree 2, and you'll see it's already pretty yucky. I actually want degree 3, but okay. So, first of all, you want to choose an open cover, some nice, in some sense, open cover of a group, but also of a group times group, and also a group times group times group. In principle, everything else, but to define degree 2, you just need to choose covers for all these three guys, group, group squared, and group cube. Now what nice means, I'm not going to define. It's pretty complicated again. I also need, I define double overlaps of charts of the cover But now I have double over, no, I have double overlaps for cover of G, but also I need double overlaps of cover of G times G, and I need triple overlaps of cover of G. Okay. Now what's a cochain? Well, before cochain was just a function of two group elements with values in U1. Now I'm going to have a locally defined cochain on group times group, so it's going to be some function of on each chart of the cover of G times G. But also I'm going to have some U1 valued function on double overlaps of the cover of G. Okay. So there's more information here. And these functions are U1 valued, and well, in this case, A valued, where A is abelian on the group. And I want them to be smooth. So differential group cohomologies. And then I want to impose a cocycle condition. What is that? Well, a co-boundary operator, a co-boundary map, takes a two-cochain with a three-cochain. You want that to vanish. But what's a three-cochain? Three-cochain is a even more weird thing. It's a, you now have smooth functions on single charts of G times G times G, and smooth functions on double overlaps of the cover of G times G, and triple overlaps of covers of G. It's a horrible thing. And there is some well-defined way to compute this and that from these two guys. And then you want that to vanish. Okay. And then similarly, you can define co-boundaries, and you factor by those. So definition is horrible. It's horrible if you don't use a better notation, basically. But turns out it's actually a computable thing, unlike the abstract group cohomology. Okay. Yeah, so if you ever wondered what would entail to write down a cocycle for the spin representation of SO3, that's what you need to write down. Okay, and to check. Of course, no physics textbook will write this out. It's just too messy. Okay. Okay, now I want to define locality preserving automorphism more precisely. So what is that? Well, that's the definition we lifted from Ranar, Walter, and Witteveen paper. So, okay, so we want to look at some special classes of automorphism of this quasi-local observable algebra. So let's denote by Bx of R, sort of the thickening for any set, let's call Bx of R be the R thickening of this set, just any point who is within R of that set. Say if X is just one point, it's just a unit, it's an interval of diameter to R, centered at this point. So let's Ax be the algebra of local observables on this X, and G is going to be some monotonically decreasing function, which approaches zero to infinity. So automorphism with tails, with GR tails, has the following property. Pick any subset, pick some observable in this subset, apply it to automorphism. Then for any radius R, you can find some local observable which approximates alpha of A with this accuracy. Which means that as R gets bigger, you have a uniform bound on how well you can approximate. The accuracy gets better and better. And somehow the point is that the accuracy of approximation doesn't depend on which A you choose. There's one function, G of R, which takes care of that. That's what this tail function is. So that's a very natural class. It's a very natural notion of what it means to preserve locality approximately. Okay, so then this local, that's a definition. So if there's some function G which does that. For example, for a QCA, simply this guy where the G of R just vanishes for especially large radii, the radius of this QCA. On the other hand, time evolution with a finite range Hamiltonian is a similar thing, but now this G of R decays exponentially. And I also mentioned that if you want to define smooth, maps from some Lie group, abstract Lie group to that gadget, you want to restrict yourself a bit even further. Namely, you want to somehow be able to define notion of a smooth map, so there's, or at least smooth curve in your group of automorphisms. And for that, it's convenient to choose this G of R to be like this, for example. It's not a unique choice, but it's a very natural choice to require. your function, tail function, decay faster than any power. That's what it means. So can be exponential, can be slightly slower, but should be faster than any power. And there's a very natural notion of infinite, it's in a very natural sense, infinite dimensional Lie group. And then you can define wins by a smooth map. Okay, so I'm not gonna discuss this. Finally, let me just indicate what goes into the proof. I'll only indicate what goes into the proof for the case when the group is abstract group, not a Lie group. In that case, one needs to know that you don't really use Hamiltonian anyway. You only want to use that gapped, the ground state of a gapped Hamiltonian has a split property. What it means? Well, suppose you have this ground state of a Hamiltonian, and you can ask, okay, can I think of this state as somehow where left and right half of the chain are somehow weakly entangled? What does it mean weakly? Well, you can look for, like, you can imagine just observables on the left and on the right, pick some, well, to make sense of it, you need the Hilbert space. So how do you get Hilbert space? Well, there's a Genèse construction which tells you if you have a state, you can get the Hilbert space. So let's look at some pure state for the left chain, some pure state for the right chain, right half chain. So then use these states to compute some Hilbert space. And you can ask, can the state of the whole chain be thought of as a vector in that Genèse Hilbert space? And if you can do it this way, because you say the state has split property, kind of splits in some sense. It's close to being a sort of product, being a product of left and right state. Well, it turns out that so Matsui proved that indeed this property just follows from the area law, which was previously proved by Hastings. So actually, in our proof, we only need the split property. So actually, by his result of Hastings, and Matsui only uses area law. So basically, our result works for any states which satisfy the area law. So I said that if you have a non-trivial anomaly index, then no gene variant state can have area law. In particular, no gap ground state of a finite Hamiltonian can be gene variant. So I guess I'll stop here. Yeah, the index can be defined in two dimensions too. Like you can define the element in H4 for the anomalies, but there's no like one can show some results. One can say that if the Hamiltonian, if you have a gapped Hamiltonian, you cannot have a short-range entangled state, which is symmetric if the group has an anomaly index, but what it implies for gap state, I'm not sure, because there's no analog of Matsui's result for two-dimensional systems.
Are there any property like this for 2D?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, there's some weak Hug duality or something, I don't know. But anyway, the point, we expect that a non-trivial anomaly prohibits states with which are short-range entangled or invertible. Not you can have non-trivial anomaly and symmetry if your ground state is the realized topological order. We don't expect as strong results as this one in two dimensions.
Question on this differential cohomology. So you think it also used to define something analogous to this omega d plus 1 of PG, meaning a situation where you don't have just cohomology but also going to.
Yeah, so, well, gravitational, I don't know about that. Well, you can. This differential cohomology, basically, I think there's the right way to deal with Lie groups. For example, the index for SPT phases can define the same considerations apply there. One can define an index for, say, two dimensional SPT phases for Lie group symmetry, which I expect is in this H4 of BG. But for gravitational stuff, there's nothing you can.
Doesn't have any ideas. I think that the question, the problem of writing down, classifying the actions for the dimension of each theories and how would they transform under this duality is kind of still the
it's a bit different than field theory, so I'm not sure this has any implications for field theory. I mean, the interesting question, I can never understand how to classify Sitcher and Simons terms for disconnected groups. What exactly is the answer? Yeah, if you ignore the gravitational issues, then this differentiable cohomology seems like a natural candidate. But of course, you need to think about.
It's not like what, what you would have to analyze the angles for this flat.
Yeah.
For gauge groups which are discrete.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a more subtle question, quantum field theory.
So let me make sure I didn't misunderstand your statement. Do we claim that LS anomaly is not a Hooke anomaly? What you mean is that the Hooke anomaly doesn't involve symmetric symmetries, but now that is the eminent symmetry is coming from that is translation, for example, anomaly should involve eminent symmetry. So then, in that sense, LS anomaly is different.
Well, I mean, QFT, you can imagine that some eminent symmetry, emergent symmetry has a mixed anomaly with the rest of the symmetry. In lattice, you can just have translations having a mixed anomaly. There's no problem there. So that cannot happen in QFT. You can never have translation mixed. All I'm saying is that, so I'm just saying that the simple fact that you can have translations mixed with anomaly mixed between translations and internal symmetry on the lattice, but not on QFT. In QFT, it can have anomalies between these eminent symmetries, which come from translation, but not with actual translations.
Yeah.
There's a matching anomaly.
You don't have to expect. We expect that if you have a QFT in the infrared, indeed there should be some manifestation of the anomaly. Yeah, like eminent symmetry mixed with some, which mixes anomaly with the rest. But it would be very hard, difficult to prove. Yeah.
Yeah, so that is this statement. Sorry.
Constraints on what?
On the ability to realize certain SPGs, like if it's protective or something like that. Otherwise, you can be
able to stop it. Yeah, but we sort of already know that, yeah. We know that. That you cannot realize integer quantum Hall states or fractional quantum Hall states with the commutative projective Hamiltonians into dimensions. So yeah, it's consistent with it, but it doesn't really tell us anything new. Yeah, maybe, but I think it's, well, that's another way, I guess, to approach the same question. I guess I just want to say that a priori, it's not obvious that SPT phases and anomalies of this are classified by the same thing. So logically, it's independent things. It's a conjecture that they're related in some precise way. So so we already know that SPT phases cannot be realized by Hamiltonians for the U1 in two dimensions. And there's a similar result for anomalies, but even in SPT phases, better just study SPT phases. I don't think it's not a theorem that the two things should really match.
Any other questions? Thank you again.